funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Few of us will ever see most of the Pacific Ocean, let alone all of the places tied to it. It is simply too large to take in as a whole, and it represents incredible cultural and natural diversity. It has the highest mountains and deepest trenches, the most seismic activity on the planet, and it is the birthplace of global weather systems. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. With thousands of years of history to consider, journalist Simon Winchester decided to limit himself to what's happened in and around the Pacific Ocean since 1950, which, as the subtitle of his new book suggests, is a lot. The book is called Pacific: Silicone Ships and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. Simon, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much indeed. Sorry about this incredibly long subtitle, but it was devised by my editor in New York. It's all to do with Google searches, apparently.
It's a good subtitle, but it's funny because our practice on this show is to sort of say the subtitle whenever we say the book, so we'll need to just build in the little extra time for that.
Well, I'm sorry. Right.
So you say that the Pacific Ocean is coming to symbolize the future. What do you mean by that?
Well, I suppose the basic thesis is that I've always thought the Mediterranean is the inland sea of the classical world, and I think we probably all agree with that. And the Atlantic Ocean was or is the inland sea of today's world. But the Pacific is the meeting place of the two great civilizations that, if you look back to when we all evolved from Ethiopia and one branch went off to the right and through Mesopotamia and the Indus Valley to Peking Man and so forth, and the other branch went to the left and went off to Europe and then crossed the Atlantic and went to the Americas and then pressed on further west to the shores of the Pacific. Then, after Magellan first crossed it in 1529, the two great civilizations, as it were, met, confronted each other, stood and considered what to do with one another, and are now in a position where they're meeting and mingling and creating, in my view, the world of the future. Whether the critics agree with that is something the book's only just been published, so we'll see what they say. But that's the sort of overarching or underpinning thesis of the book.
And the ocean itself is far more vast than what we define as Asia-Pacific, although that has been the limit of our thinking about the Pacific for a long time.
Well, and I very much wanted to change that and try and look at the Pacific as a whole, you know, from the Aleutians to Cape Horn, from Indonesia to the Panama Canal. And it's, you're quite right, it's absolutely vast, what, 64 million square miles. It can happily accommodate all the other oceans and the continents quite easily with room to spare. And Robinson Jeffers, the great California poet, called it the great unsleeping eye of the Earth, because if you look at the planet from space, the dominant thing is this big blue entity, which, of course, never closes. And, yes, its size is far greater than merely Asia-Pacific. And I can't remember how many countries, but all the myriad islands in between tend to get ignored as well, just as do, Chile and Colombia and Canada, as well as, of course, Australia and the United States, that make up the Pacific. So I try and broaden the reach of the book to encompass much more than just Asia-Pacific.
You are not known for taking on easy topics, but this one really does take the cake. And you decided to organize this. There's a classic work that you used for inspiration by Stefan Zweig.
Yes, I just happened upon Stefan Zweig, actually, when I was doing research for the book, and I found that he had written an extremely good memoir of Magellan. And I thought, well, who is this chap? Knew very little about him, except that he was a bit player in the Wes Anderson movie of the great, hotel.
Budapest Hotel.
Exactly, that came out last year. And so I thought I'd read my way through him and was completely fascinated by almost everything he wrote. This Austrian Jewish author who died in Brazil in 1942, depressed by the state of the world, but having been one of the most popular writers in the world in the 1920s and 30s. And he had written a book which has a variety of titles, but basically It's 10 events that shaped the modern world, and they were an eccentric collection of things like the composing of the Star-Spangled Banner and the death of Socrates and reaching the South Pole and all kinds of very eccentric collection, very eclectic, to use the modish word. And I thought I might try and approach the Pacific in that way, and beginning in 1950, in the 65 years since, try and divine a number of episodes, and I thought 10 would be a good number, each of these episodes, each different from the other and occurring in chronological order, which seemed to betoken a major trend in the Pacific, which would add up at the end, offering a sort of pointillist portrait of what I think, anyway, the Pacific is all about today and tomorrow. And so I sort of scoured the newspapers and the archives and came up with about 250 events. And then winnowed them down to 10. And, of course, once again, it'll be up to the critics to see whether they think that those 10 were the right choices. And but at the moment, I'm relatively happy with them.
What's the significance of New Year's Day 1950?
Yes, that's all to do with the dating techniques that we use today. I mean, it's now generally accepted that BC and AD relate only to Christian eras, and so they're often discarded, particularly BC. We tend to use BCE, which means before Common Era or before Christian Era. But the scientific community uses another convention, BP. They talk about things like the Wisconsin Ice Age as having occurred 10,000 years BP, and that stands for before present. But then it prompts the question, well, when is or was present? And radiochemists decided that present, the index year, if you like, should be January 1950. And the reason for that is that before 1950, it was possible to do carbon-14 dating and expect a high degree of accuracy because we knew the ratio of stable carbon-12 and unstable carbon-14 with that very famous half-life of, 7,530 years. So that was all hunky-dory until we started doing atomic testing, mostly as it happens in the Pacific Ocean. And one of the byproducts of atomic tests is carbon-14. So we pumped lots and lots of additional C-14 into the atmosphere, which made all the calculations of aging of wildly out of whack. And so we had to introduce algorithms. So during the period when we were testing, carbon-14 dating was unreliable. And so radiochemists like to say that before January 1950, the world was pure, and after 1950, it became impure. And that seemed, because the impurities nearly all came from the Pacific, that seemed a very good date for me to choose for the beginning of the story.
How did the United States choose test sites for hydrogen bomb and other nuclear capabilities?
Well, basically, because after the end of the Second World War, when we had pushed the Japanese out of the thousands of islands that they had occupied, they had begun to occupy them after the First World War, there was an enormous amount of real estate that was essentially controlled or influenced by the United States. And when President Truman, on the 4th of January 1950, so that's the first incident, if you like, that I talk about in this book, announced that America was going to start testing this new generation of huge weapons, thermonuclear weapons, they decided that they would test them somewhere in the Pacific where they had an immense amount of real estate. And they decided in the end that it had to be, the test site had to be within easy range of a major airfield. And there was an airfield in the Marshall Islands, a place called Kwajalein. And so they looked around for something within about 500 miles of Kwajalein so that an aircraft carrying one of these big bombs could get there, drop it and get back. And they happened upon this very large atoll called Bikini. And one of the islands is Bikini, but in the atoll itself there are about 60 or 70 islands. And they surveyed that and decided that they would use that as the test bed. Principally, and the reason for testing them at sea was that it was the Navy that thought that it was most vulnerable to atomic weapons. Because if you fire an atom bomb, whether fission or thermonuclear, at an army, they can, you know, dive into bunkers and build themselves concrete shelters and so forth and escape. And similarly, airfields, the planes can scatter. But a ship, something like an aircraft carrier, is hugely vulnerable. It can't move very fast, and so an atomic bomb dropped on an aircraft carrier would likely do it incredible damage and probably sink it. So they decided, the Navy, that the early weapons, they would test them on ships. And so an atoll, which is an enclosed body of water, would be an ideal place to anchor target ships. And so that's what they did in the early 1950s, or late 1940s, actually. They would bring 20, 30 big ships, mainly warships, some cargo ships as well, anchor them in the lagoon, and then from Kwajalein bring an aircraft, drop a bomb, and see what happens. So the basic reason for the using the Pacific and using Bikini is because it was American, because it was remote, and because it offered a sheltered lagoon for testing the effect of the bombs on ships.
The fact that communities of people lived in the Bikini Atoll was apparently not a major consideration for the U.S. military.
It's quite extraordinary the way the people were treated. I mean, they're utterly bizarre. The Americans who came in to persuade the few hundred Bikinians who had been living the peaceful, contented life, just fishing and picking coconuts and weaving mats and living a life of total, blissful sort of South Pacific peace. They were all Christians because Christian missionaries had come there in the 19th century. And so the American sailors who came to persuade them to evacuate the island said, you remember the passage from, and it was somewhere in the Old Testament, the Israelites were led out behind a pillar of fire. Well, we Americans can create a pillar of fire by dropping this new weapon. So that's a signal that you should leave. I mean, a bizarre piece of cunning formulation. So the Bikinians did leave, and the Americans dropped their bombs and completely contaminated the islands. And 1978, it was believed that the radiation had reduced itself to acceptable levels, and they came back, but found in fact that the radiation was deeply buried in the soil and that the vegetables they were growing were contaminated with radioactive cesium, and they had to be evacuated again. And they've been evacuated ever since. And oddly enough, by extraordinary coincidence, the foreign minister of the Marshall Islands, of which the Bikini is one of them, he's in London as we speak, and pleading with the British government, and I know he's coming here to America to offer a same plea, saying these poor Bikinians who have been evicted from their homeland are now corralled on a little island in the Southern Marshalls, which is being threatened by rising sea levels and global warming. So can they be offered a home either in Britain or the United States? So this is a problem caused by the Americans, which still will not go away.
And we had told them initially that they could go back as soon as we had exploded this thing.
And they believed us. They were completely trusting and said, well, you know, we'll happily offer our island in the service of world peace, or whatever the argument that put to them by the American Navy. And you'll be back in a trice, you know, in a few months. But that was not the case. The amount of radioactivity in the soil is prodigious. The only people that go to Bikini now are very wealthy divers who are taken at great expense into the lagoon, and they don't go on shore, they stay on a dive boat, and they dive on the wrecks of the ships that were the target ships and which apparently are now home to all sorts of brightly coloured and probably highly radioactive fish. But you get very wealthy divers going there, and the poor Bikinians are marooned on an island being flooded and are very unhappy about it all.
Journalist Simon Winchester is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Pacific: Silicone Ships and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet. My handle is @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, spending the hour with journalist Simon Winchester, author of the new book Pacific, Silicone Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. Join us at 800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. Simon, these days, the invention of the transistor radio seems like a sort of quaint moment in time, but in fact, it had significant implications really globally and certainly for East-West trade.
It really did. The first appearance of these radio sets was in, of all places, Edmonton, Alberta, where I was a few days ago, and Edmonton really gets written about, and I think they're very proud to know that they played a role in the Pacific's future. Basically, what happened was that in a few electronics shops, one in Edmonton, one in Winnipeg, and one in Vancouver, there appeared these tiny little shirt pocket-sized radio sets, which were completely different from anything that had ever been known before, because up to that point, radio sets were pieces of furniture. You know, they were covered with walnut veneer, and you put the aspidistra on them, and they switched them on, and they warmed up. Well, all of a sudden, there was a device which you could hear your favourite radio stations on, but you could take it out into the garden, you could take it with you in the car, it became immediately portable and personal. And this little radio set, it was called the TR-55, was made in Japan by a company called Totsco, which stood for Tokyo Telecommunications Company. But in tiny little letters under the dial was this new and then unfamiliar word, the word Sony. And this was the beginning of the revolution in personal electronics. It was all, if we think of Sony, we tend to think of this rather beautiful sort of silver-haired man called Akio Morita, who's the sort of public face of Sony. But these inventions, of which the transistor radio was the first, were all made by a very working-class, very sort of rough-and-tough engineer called Masaru Ibuka, who went on to create the Walkman, if you remember that, and the Trinitron television and the Betamax, a brilliant, brilliant engineer. And the result of this, they suddenly became popular, all of these devices, and coincided with the invention in America, in actually Newport News, Virginia, of the container, the shipping container. And so within a matter of, well, a couple of years, this huge trade of devices like the TR-55 and its other personal electronic devices, television sets, came in containers from the ports of Japan, first of all, to the ports in Vancouver and Seattle and Long Beach and San Francisco. And then they started coming from Korea, and then they started coming from where they do now, which is largely China. So the whole pattern of west to east trade, which has dominated the Pacific Ocean's commerce, patterns of commerce, ever since, all began with this tiny little radio set invented in 1955. So yes, insignificant, we all take them for granted now, but their invention it changed the world quite literally.
By the way, I'm taking us back in time here, but it was so interesting for me to think about this. The international dateline was thrown down in the Pacific in the late 19th century at a time few people could imagine how important that region would be to global trade. They probably didn't think about the transistor radio or any of the other inventions that would pass from east to west. Can you talk a little bit about the effects of where the dateline is?
Well, yes. I mean, the dateline was the original idea came from a professor at a ladies' college in Saratoga, New York, who came up with the idea of time zones. And then this man called Sanford Fleming came up, well, if they've got time zones, there's got to be a place in the world where one day changes into another. And nothing happens in the Pacific, so let's put it there. And it should go roughly along the 180-degree meridian, but unfortunately, there are inconveniences. There are countries that cross the 180-degree meridian, like the Aleutian Islands, so we'd better move it a bit to the left there. And then there's Tonga and the Gilbert Islands and the Ellis Islands. So this sort of zigzaggy line still plays an important part in the Pacific. You cross it when you go on a plane to Tokyo and you lose a day. It automatically, you know, leave on Tuesday and it becomes Thursday. Or if you're going the other way, I mean, I remember vividly, I used to live in Hong Kong, and you'd leave on a plane from 10 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, flying to San Francisco, you'd cross the date line, even though you've been flying for 16 hours, and it's still Sunday, and it's still 10 o'clock in the morning, and you think, you know, this is really screwed up. But I've sort of argued, eccentrically, it'll never happen, that because the Pacific is now so commercially important, and it would be very nice if people could do business with each other on the same day, so that, let's say, a business person in San Francisco could ring up someone in Tokyo, and it would still be Friday when it's Friday in San Francisco, but now actually it's Saturday, so the fellow is on holiday playing golf. If that didn't eventuate because the dateline was somewhere else, the Atlantic Ocean, then commercial life across the Pacific would be that much simpler. So I've advocated, somewhat facetiously it must be said, that where the Greenwich Meridian is now, because the Atlantic is less important commercially than the Pacific, that the dateline should be there, such that when it's Monday in Paris, it's actually Tuesday in New York. It's never going to happen, but it's something I think it prompts people to think about it.
El Niños are born in the Pacific, and they have this huge, and it turns out now surprising in the era of global warming, effect on global weather systems.
The El Niño really does. I mean, it's beginning as we speak, this sudden change in the currents and the temperature just off Peru, which caused this thing tended to happen around Christmas time, which is why the phenomenon was known by fishermen as El Niño, the Christ Child. And what happened was that the north-flowing cold current, which came up from the Antarctic and allowed anchoveta, little baby anchovies, to flourish, which gave Peru one of the biggest fishing industries in the world, it suddenly stopped flowing or moved offshore, and the waters became much warmer, the anchovies died, and seabirds that fed on them died, and so there was a lot of rotting unpleasantness, which caused, oddly enough, masses of dead creatures to be found in the sea, which caused the paint on ships to blister because of the gases. I mean, it sounds very bizarre, but that's the kind of thing that happened. So this phenomenon, which happened every few years, was given the name El Niño, but it meant the fishing in that part of the Pacific became much, much diminished. Well, it turns out that now we know about El Niños and their effect, that they do have an extraordinary effect on the weather in the world. And it's all to do with the pressure systems and the upper atmosphere wind and the currents in the Pacific, all affected in a series of subtly and not totally fully understood interconnected movements, which leads to, we talk about today's El Niño, is causing these new massive downpours of rains in California, will probably increase the snowpack in Northern California to everyone's great relief, because California has been suffering from this drought, and will have effects all over the planet, I mean, as far away as Europe. So as the Pacific, as its weather unfolds, so does the weather in the rest of the world, which is why it's crucially important now for the world's leading meteorological organizations to study the Pacific in detail. And there's one big computer that I write about a lot in Tokyo, or just to the west of Tokyo, called the Earth Simulator 2, which can produce instant pictures of the world's weather every 6 seconds. And they're looking at the patterns that are developing, particularly the pattern of a upper atmosphere winds known as the Walker circulation, which was invented, and the reason I mention it is not to become horribly technical, because I love the man who, it's an eponymous wind pattern, Gilbert Walker, who was a British meteorologist based in Delhi in the 1920s, and he studied the monsoon. But his big fascination was with the mechanics of boomerangs. So I love the thought that an eccentric English boomerang expert gives us his name to a weather pattern which dominates and causes the El Niño, which in turn dominates the weather of the world. So let's hear it for boomerangs.
Well, since you brought up boomerangs, we should talk about Australia, which is such an interesting country. It is right there, certainly a Pacific nation. Of course, it's got the Indian Ocean, you know, on its west side, but it is not quite like anything else in the region, but not like anything in Europe where, you know, originated the colonial powers that established it as what it is today.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the the role that Australia plays in the Pacific is something I'm completely fascinated by, because it's gigantic, it has a huge Pacific coastline, and it is or should be, in my view, part of the Pacific community. But there's this undertow still existing in the Australia of today. A lot of Australians will say, not really part of the Pacific community. We're really an outlier of the British Empire. And indeed, the Queen still plays a role, a significant role, in the government of the country. And there was a notorious event in the 1970s, which all Australians remember, that called the Dismissal, where a very ebullient and very sort of active Prime Minister called Gough Whitlam, who unfortunately spent money like a drunken sailor and so nearly bankrupted the country, was thrown out of office, not by his people, but by the Queen of England, and or at least her representative in Australia. And I think that outraged a lot of Australians, who said, well, come on, we're standing on our own two feet. We're part of the Pacific community. We're not going to have our leash tugged from time to time by Britain. Probably that'll never happen again. But the undertow that I mentioned is still part of the Australian affect, if you like, because from time to time there's an upsurge in what's been known as the White Australia policy, which is really to favour white immigration and not to have as many Asians as want to come knocking on the door. And at the moment, the immigration policy of Australia is pretty harsh. And if you're someone from South Asia or East Asia who comes by boat to Australia hoping to get in, and after all, they've got tons and tons of space, they could accommodate millions more than they have, they're turned away and treated pretty brutally, put in these horrible, horrible resettlement camps, none of them in Australia, but in islands, Nauru, a horrible former phosphate quarry in the middle of the Pacific, Papua New Guinea, or an island in the Indian Ocean called Christmas Island. And they're left to rot while their applications are very, very slowly considered. And the effect of all of this is that the brother and sister nations to their north, China, Japan, Korea, Indonesia, are saying, well, is Australia one of us? Is it truly part of the Pacific community? Or is it still effectively a white-dominated country which owes everything or is still part of a very distant European empire? And Australia is still working through that process. So I go down there to tour this book in February, and I know I've been relatively critical of Australia, although I love it. It's a wonderful, wonderful country. But it still hasn't quite come to terms with what I think it must be, and that's fully committed and enfolded into the Pacific Ocean.
Is there a lot of activism by Indigenous peoples and people who have come from neighboring Asian states demonstrating for their rights, or are they still pretty marginalized?
No, then that's a very good question. No, I mean, the whole business of the Aboriginal Australians has generally been, I mean, there have been a lot of apologies, there's been a lot of money spent. The condition of many of the reservations or areas where most Aboriginal people live is pretty atrocious in many places. And going back to the point I was making earlier, that from time to time there's a sort of a spasm of anti-Asian, anti-immigrant, anti-non-white people. Most recently, this extraordinary politician, sort of Australia's version of Sarah Palin, if you like, called Pauline Hanson, comes from Queensland, where she ran a fish and chip shop. She came briefly to prominence, got a seat in the Australian House of Parliament, and declaimed her total opposition to immigration of non-white people, and was very, very critical of the Aboriginal communities. And she remained a potent force in Australian politics for many years. But then she went to prison, so things didn't look terribly good for her. But she's out and about again now, and she's still, there's this, I know I used the word a number of times, this undertow, which is not doing Australia any favours and makes most of her Asian neighbour countries look at her with somewhat arched eyebrows.
How healthy is the Pacific Ocean today?
Not in good shape, basically. We have the problem of rising sea levels, of course, which are common to all oceans. In the Pacific, it's getting very hot. So the global warming is affecting the Pacific, which is a great heat sink, if you like. And also the acidification of the ocean is increasing by leaps and bounds. And the consequence of this, the sort of canary in the coal mine in the Pacific Ocean, is the state and health of the coral reefs, and most particularly the largest living organism on the face of this earth, which is the 1,400-mile-long living coral reef, the Great Barrier Reef, which extends from along most of the upper sort of right-hand side of Australia, from Brisbane up to Cape York. That is in very bad shape, and it's decaying or bleaching. Bleaching is the problem. The creatures known as the zooxanthellae, which give it its colour, are dying because they're incredibly sensitive to both acidification and rising temperatures. And it is said that the Great Barrier Reef, which is a World Heritage Site, may no longer exist in 20 or 30 years. I mean, just about half of it has already been severely damaged. And the World Heritage, the organisation, UNESCO, I think it is, or UNICEF, that gives out this label, is threatening to withdraw its support for this entity, because the reef is being threatened not just by natural phenomena, but also by the poor stewardship of it by the Australian government, because there are a lot of coal mines, and the coal ships which go up to China pass through the reef and have done already immense damage to it. And the United Nations is saying, look, if you want this thing to be protected, you've got to protect it yourselves. You've got to help. It's in danger. And if you're not going to, then we're going to withdraw our support for it. So it's in the Pacific Ocean in general is in pretty poor shape. And the Barrier Reef is an indication of how that is so.
Journalist Simon Winchester is my guest. His new book is called Pacific: Silicone Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with journalist Simon Winchester. His new book is called Pacific: Silicone Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Simon, we've been hearing just this week about China engaging in island building to control greater swaths of territory, in this case in the South China Sea. Do they have designs on the Pacific as well?
They do, and I think it's an absolutely fascinating story. It all has to do with an admiral called Liu Huaqing, he died about 4 years ago, aged, I think, 93. And he, interestingly enough, was the commander of Chinese PLA forces who put down the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989. So he's a man with a somewhat unsavory reputation. He devised a stratagem for China and the Pacific in the 1990s. What happened basically was that in 1992, there was an enormous volcanic eruption in the Philippines. A mountain called Mount Pinatubo exploded. And this blanketed two critically important American military bases, Subic Bay, and which was a naval base, and Clark Air Base. They were blanketed with dust and ash and so badly damaged that Dick Cheney, who was then the Secretary of Defense, ordered them to be closed down permanently. And this resulted in the creation of a vacuum, effectively, in the sea to the west of the Philippines, which is the South China Sea. The American forces withdrew from it and policed the area from back in Japan and Guam and places like that. Well, the vacuum was filled very nimbly by the Chinese. Under Admiral Liu's orders, they started this program of building on uninhabited coral reefs new installations. They would put up a lighthouse here or a pier there, or build a dock, build an airstrip, with the result that the Americans never did, or perhaps never were able to, do anything to stop this. I mean, it would be disproportionate for an American aircraft carrier to say, you know, stop building this lighthouse on a coral reef, because taken incident by incident, these purloining of these islands was trivial. But now there are dozens and dozens of these islands, and the South China Sea is a patchwork of Chinese-owned little miniature bases for ships and aircraft and what have you. So that is being tested as we speak. And we'll have all read the news about this destroyer, the USS Lassen, that is deliberately sailing close to these islands to tell the Chinese, these are international waters, don't claim them as your own. But the South China Sea business is only part of the whole picture, because the same Admiral Liu says, all right, well, we're going to claim control of the South China Sea, but also we're going to extend our interests far beyond into the blue water ocean itself. And so they've come up with this idea of what they call the first, the second, and the third island chain, sort of imaginary groups of, well, islands that exist, but that they are sort of defensive chains lying to protect China. One of them, the first one, is a line of islands that extends from Japan to Indonesia. The second one from the Kamchatka Peninsula down to Australia. And the third island chain, from the Aleutian Islands through Hawaii down to New Zealand. And so by 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China, the Chinese Navy intends, first of all, to make sure that it has a blue water navy operating within the first island chain, by about 2020, 2025, within the second island chain, and by 2049, she'll have her aircraft carriers. She's got one now. She's got four on order. Will be operating off Hawaii, and the admirals, the American admirals sitting in Pearl Harbor, will look out of their windows and see, undeniably, a big force of Chinese aircraft carriers and destroyers and so forth sitting off the Hawaiian Islands. And this is giving the Pentagon collywobbles, because they're really, perhaps collywobbles isn't making a shudder run down their spines, yeah. Because the assumption has been that the Pacific is effectively an American lake and has been since the 1940s. The Chinese are saying, we mean no harm to anybody, but this isn't an American lake. We want naval equivalence. We want to be able to, our Navy, to go as far into the east as you have gone far into the west. And that is likely to provide something of a confrontation with the forces in the Pentagon.
Do you think the Chinese mean no harm? Do they have acquisitory intentions?
Well, all I can point to is Chinese history. And I accept from this, of course, the situation of the Tibetans, which is tragic and not a good story at all. But generally speaking, the Chinese have been content through most of their history to remain within their own borders. Yes, they created sort of satrapies in Indochina. There was the war with India over a territory called the Aksai Chin in the 1960s. But generally speaking, and this is the Chinese, of course, have this tremendous historical perspective. They remind us that the last time there was a major Chinese, as it were, imperial expedition was in 1425, when Cheng He, who was Chinese, yes, but also a Muslim and a eunuch, took a fleet which went as far as, they know it went as far as Mogadishu, and they brought back for the emperor, among other things, a giraffe. And they brought it into the palace in Beijing. And he was apparently so horrified and said, if the world is full of animals like this, then I don't want anything to do with it, and you mustn't go sailing or exploring ever again. And it became for hundreds of years illegal for Chinese fishermen to venture more than 3 miles offshore. And big boats were burned and destroyed. China had no interest in the outside world for a long time. And it's long been puzzlement as to why, you know, we, as it were, discovered China. Why didn't the Chinese ever discover Europe? But I believe on the basis of that, that no, the Chinese probably still have no overseas territorial ambitions. They merely want to be accepted as an equal partner with the Americans in policing the oceans of the world, but no more than that. This may, however, and I fully accept it, be a very naive way of thinking. And I dare say the admirals in the Pentagon and in San Diego and Hawaii are saying, shaking their head and saying, no, the Chinese want territory and we've got to watch out.
How has a country as poor and tiny and geographically isolated and frankly backward as North Korea come to be such a perpetual worry to its neighbors and also, of course, to the United States and its allies?
It is an extraordinary story, really. To me, in a way, the most extraordinary aspect of the history of North Korea is that it was invented by an American with a wonderful name. He was called Charles Hartwell Bonesteel III. You can't really get a better name than that. And he was sitting in the Pentagon in 1945, August the 14th, and he, with a colleague, another, he was a young army colonel, and he was sitting with Colonel Dean Rusk, who later went on to be Secretary of State in John Kennedy's administration. And they were in the outer office of George Marshall, who was the chief of staff for the army. And they were listening over the shortwave radio to the Emperor of Japan, Hirohito, making this speech, you know, this great understatement, the progress of the war has not necessarily gone to our advantage, and surrendering. And so the two colonels, expecting this was what was going to happen, sort of wiped their hands and said, well, that's terrific. That's the Japanese problem over. The problem now is what to do about the Soviets, because the Soviet Union had joined the war just a few days previously, and their troops were marching down through all the Japanese-held territory, Sakhalin Island, Manchuria, Korea, booting them out. And the fear in Washington suddenly was, now the Japanese problem was over, that the Far East would become colonized, overrun by the Soviet Union. We'd have a communist Japan, a communist Korea. And this was, you know, the beginnings of the fears of the whole Cold War hysteria. This could not happen. So these two colonels said, well, we've got to get the Soviets to stop their advance. So they had a 1944 copy of the National Geographic magazine on the desk, and in it, one of those folded up maps, in this case, of Japan and the North Pacific. Spread it out on the desk, and they noticed that San Francisco and Seoul were almost exactly on the same latitude, 37 degrees 30 north. And Bonesteel said, you know, I think it's important that the old capital, traditional capital of Korea, of course Korea at this time was a colony of Japan, that we, with the Americans, have it. So he drew a line a wee bit north of Seoul, 38 degrees, and said to Rusk, don't you think the 38th parallel should do it? And Rusk said, that sounds a capital idea. So they took it in to George Marshall and recommended that they ask the Russians to stop at 38 north. And he said, that's a good idea. I'll get onto the State Department. We'll ask Moscow. And Moscow, incredibly, the day after, 16th of August, said, you know, we're getting pretty tired. Our tanks are getting bogged down in the mud. It's height of summer. Troops are pretty exhausted coming through Manchuria, hundreds of miles. So, yes, we'll stop at the 38th parallel. You Americans can take the surrender of the Japanese in the south. We'll appoint our point man, Kim Il-sung, in the north. And the Americans said, OK, we'll appoint someone, Yi Sing-man, Sing-man Rhee. And as a result of that, two completely new countries were born, which then, 5 years later, went to war with each other. And then the war was ended, but only an armistice was signed, never a fully formed peace treaty. So the countries are still notionally at war with this very heavily fortified 4-kilometer-wide DMZ between them. And the North, impoverished, as you say, and having developed nuclear weapons and being perpetually bellicose and unpleasant, a major thorn in everyone's side. And one has to wonder that if Bonesteel had not drawn that line and the Russians had taken the whole of the peninsula and Korea, therefore, had become, like Vietnam, like Cambodia, a communist state, that it might now no longer be a communist state and it would be unified still, and there would be no North Korea. So Charles Hartwell Bonesteel performed a service or a disservice, which unwittingly, of course, which lingers still a major, major problem.
What role do you see the United States playing in the peaceful stewardship of the Pacific? And are there things that we're trying to do now that we ought to pull back from?
Well, that's a good and complex question. Yes, we are doing a lot of things which relate to the peaceful stewardship of the Pacific Ocean. We recognize that there's been an enormous amount of environmental damage that we've done. Our colonial era behavior has essentially ended. In other words, we're no longer in Southeast Asia. Britain, one of the major colonial powers in the Pacific, has withdrawn from everywhere. The only British possession is little Pitcairn Island, which just has 46 people living on it and will soon, I think, become totally extinguished. The French have a fairly sizable area, which is still sends representatives to the Assemblée Nationale in Paris. So that's still colonial possessions. But I think the Americans in particular, who take the lead in the Pacific, are realizing in this post-colonial Pacific area that one of the things we can do is to preserve the ocean from pollution and overfishing. And as a result, George W. Bush, the last of the Bushes, declared huge tracts of the Pacific a protected area. And President Obama has gone one step further. Hundreds of thousands of square miles are now fully protected from longline fishing and all sorts of potentially damaging activities. So stewardship of the ocean itself is being performed with at least noble intentions by the Americans. But at the same time, the discoveries that once again Americans have made of the black smokers and the big mineral fields, also in the Pacific, uniquely in the Pacific, they're being exploited largely by Australian companies who are lowering huge machines onto the seabed to claw these minerals out. So while on the one hand, fish and wildlife and coral reefs, there's an attempt to protect them. On the other side, other countries are attempting to claw the mineral wealth out of the Pacific, causing great damage, collateral damage at the same time. So you win some and you lose some. But I think the intentions of the Americans anyway are pretty good.
The new book by journalist Simon Winchester is Pacific: Silicone Chips and Surfboards, Coral Reefs and Atom Bombs, Brutal Dictators, Fading Empires, and the Coming Collision of the World's Superpowers. Simon, it is always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Well, thank you. It's been lovely talking to you down there. Thanks so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Natalie Kalman-Kuhn. Our executive producer, is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.